Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our focus today on the youngest of 11 children and one of five brothers who served in World War II. Cal Erickson is 92 years old now, and he's lived for decades in the Santa Clarita area of Southern California. You'll find photos and videos of Cal at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks to his niece, Andrea, for letting me know about Cal and his brother, Grant, who we're going to hear from next week. Grant was in the Navy and survived some very close calls. Cal was in the U.S. Army Air Corps and flew 13 missions as a B-26 Marauder pilot. But if you read a page titled Mayday, Mayday in the book that he wrote 10 years ago, you might be surprised he made it to actual combat flying after what he went through in training. Describing what he calls an unforgettable adventure in an AT-17 twin-engine advanced trainer in Douglas, Arizona, Cal writes, "Robert Irk and I were assigned to a cross-country navigational flight. I was the pilot on the outward leg and Irk on the return trip when we encountered strong headwinds. When we were still a long way from the runway, the red light indicated 20 minutes of fuel remaining. As we neared the runway, we informed the tower of our problem and asked for permission to come straight in for a landing. It was denied, and we were told to circle around for a landing into the wind. We did as requested, but as we started our approach, both engines died. We were out of gas with nothing but rough terrain below us. Irk decided to land it with the wheels down instead of bellying in with the wheels up. When that 6'4", 250-pound Texan said, 'Put the wheels down,' I followed his directions as co-pilot. Things happened so fast. We both instinctively pushed and pulled on the controls depending on the terrain. We landed by bouncing over sagebrush, plowing through a fence, and bouncing in and out of a small ditch, eventually coming to rest almost on our nose. After we stopped, Irk turned to me and asked, 'How's that for a ride, little buddy?' Being so big, that's what he called all of us. Fortunately, our landing was visible from the airbase, and within minutes, there was an ambulance and fire engine on the scene along with the commanding officer. Neither of us had as much as a scratch, and the CO asked us where we were hiding our lucky horseshoes. Even though we had gone against the odds by not making a belly landing in that terrain, we had essentially saved the plane, so we were not reprimanded. The traffic controller who had denied our emergency request was relieved of his duty." So that's quite the story to read about, and if you turn the next page, you'll find a smiling photo of Cal after graduating from training as a second lieutenant and earning those silver wings.
So you get your own crew. You're 21 years old, and you have five other guys on your plane that you're responsible for.
That's right.
How did that feel?
Felt pretty good, but that's what I was asking for. I wanted to be my own boss, so to speak, have control of the plane. It was good getting to know everybody. And they probably thought I was some kind of, you know, young punk kid. But actually, we all were. We were just bunch of young guys that are, my co-partner was 26 years old, and we called him the old man, you know. We were all like 19, 20, 21. So that was good.
That's what always gets me, maybe the most. And I think about you and, you know, your four brothers here. You're all young men out there doing that, but you just hit on it in your crew alone. You're 21. You're the captain of this bomber, and you've got these other guys that are still teenagers. And I think of our teenagers today. And here's millions of teenagers off there fighting and winning a war.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to believe in retrospect, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Well, and I guess it begs the question, what was different then compared to now? Could we do that again in our country today?
I wonder, yeah. I mean, I look at my grandkids and other kids. I'm sure they could, yeah.
If it came to that.
If they came to that.
Which none of us ever wants, but it is something to ponder. And as a young man who had been eager to be a pilot, eager to get into the service, I imagine you were eager to get overseas.
I was, yeah. That was my goal.
But you didn't get to leave the States until January of 45?
That's right, yeah.
And up to that point, you have other brothers serving in other parts of the war. How often did you hear from them or about what they were doing?
Not often, but I didn't hear that from them directly. I'd hear news of it from my mother. Mm-hmm. She was always faithful in writing, and one or two of my sisters, older sisters, they would write.
Have you ever thought about that, what it must have been like for your mother with five sons in this war?
Yeah, I have. At the time, though, you know, when you're young like that, I never realized that I would take, you know, when I was in Merced, which was close to home, I would take our group of guys home with me sometimes when we'd have a little leave. I didn't realize what they were going through, but they would let me have the car, and gas was rationed, you know.
Yeah.
Food was rationed. We'd mm-hmm. always eat good. Actually, my dad was a very strict person, always was. One time when I was leaving on one of those trips, he actually cried. And sorry. I couldn't believe it because I'd never seen any emotion from him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's helping us understand what it was really like.
Mm.
And I'm sure it wasn't any easier for your brothers. I'm sure they saw that side of things too. So they decide to let you, when you're heading overseas, they gave you a brand new B-26 and said, hey, just get it over there somehow?
That's right. Yeah.
How did that all unfold?
Well, it was, they had some planes they had to deliver overseas, and there were a lot of people going over, but I was chosen as, I think there were four new planes.
Uh-huh.
I was chosen as one of the pilots. I figured, well, they must trust me with their new plane, so away we went.
Was it smooth sailing all the way?
Well, yeah, it was. We had to wait. The only concern I had was hitting this Ascension Island right in the middle of the ocean that was, you know, 1,000 miles away or something. And
yeah.
So we had a navigator for that portion. That was quite a thrill to find that little piece of land out there in the middle of the ocean.
I've heard some stories about that place, and especially in bad weather, how difficult it could be to find, but I'm glad you found it. You made it across, and by this time, because of the progress of the Allied forces, your base, where you flew from, was actually a base that had been used by the Germans, the Luftwaffe, earlier in the war. This was in France. What did you realize about the place where you flew from once you got there? What was your first impression?
Well, it was not a very big place. The first thing that happened was when we got there that wanted to know where we were going to bunk. All the people there said you can have this bunk or that bunk or the other one because they're not coming back. And that was because they actually quite fortunate I got over there when I did, because if I'd have gotten over there earlier, there would have been a good chance that I wouldn't be coming back, because the weather socked in early December. So it stayed that way and almost all the way through December. And December, as I recall the date, December 23rd, the weather broke and the planes could take off. And in all that time, the Germans, I think they were pretty well sure they were on their last effort, and they let them have it with everything that they had stocked up in the last 3 or 4
yeah.
weeks. There were a lot of planes shot down.
Yeah. So if you had gotten there earlier, you likely would have been shot down, either killed or become a prisoner. But you get there when you did. But what they tell you is, sleep wherever you want. None of these guys are coming back. That can't be very encouraging.
That was a little earth-shaking, yeah.
So does that mean you were a little apprehensive before your first mission?
Yeah, a little bit. First mission actually was probably one of the worst we saw with the flak.
Uh-huh.
And so
tell me about that first mission. Where were you supposed to bomb?
I believe it was a railroad yard.
Uh-huh.
We bombed, I don't know if it was a bridge or a railroad yard. I got up there, and then we were almost near the target, and they got all this black stuff that came up I'd never seen before.
Had you been warned about it?
Oh, yeah.
The
yeah.
anti-aircraft fire?
Anti-aircraft fire.
And you're flying in formation?
Uh-huh. And then the plane started shaking, and I turned to my co-pilot, and I said, Max, I think we're hit, you know, and it was shaking, and he took the controls, and it straightened out, and I looked down, and my legs were shaking so bad that I was putting on the it was affecting the controls, the foot controls.
So the flak hadn't hit you, but because you were so nervous, you were shaking the plane, and it felt like the flak was hitting you.
That's right, yeah.
Wow, that is a great story. Did he let you have it about that afterwards? Did he rib you?
Yeah, he did. Maybe he should have been flying instead of me.
Well, and you talk about that flak, and we've heard so many guys who flew on bomber crews talk about how helpless a feeling that was flying through flak, because you can't dodge it. You've got to stay on course in formation toward the target. And it sounds like for you, it was routine that it was a pretty close call after you dropped your bombs in peeling off and changing course, huh?
Yeah. Just as soon as you dropped the bombs, you just took off. And then you look there, and the flak would be right there where you would have been.
So you would have flown right through it and felt it.
Yeah.
And I know there were times where you did feel it, where it wasn't you shaking the controls. It was actually anti-aircraft fire penetrating your plane.
Yeah. Yeah, we got hit, and the hydraulic system got shot out. So my trusty engineer, who I really, he was my right-hand man, he cranked the wheels. When we got closer to the base, he cranked the wheels down. And, of course, we didn't have any brakes, and couldn't do anything with getting the flaps down, which slowed it down a little bit. So we landed real fast, maybe 150 miles an hour. Normal landing speed is about 125.
Uh-huh.
And I'd been told about this red button up here, red knob. Said, don't pull that. That's the air brakes. So I didn't get very far down the runway, and I said, I wonder how fast this thing is going to stop. So I was still going awfully fast. So I pulled the handle, and everything just locked up, and it skidded.
Mm-hmm.
I tied up a runway there for a while, but
you didn't skid off the runway.
No, we just skidded straight ahead.
And it's easy to laugh about it now, but 70 years ago, I don't think you were laughing.
No, I wasn't laughing, though.
Did panic set in when you know your plane is hit and you've lost this hydraulic system, which so much of what you're used to depends on? How did you respond to that? What do you remember about those tense moments?
I don't think I wasn't panicking, except I knew we were going to, I knew I was going to be able to land, and because the controls were still there. I wasn't concerned about the landing. Oh, I was really concerned about stopping before I got off the end of the runway.
Because it's not just you. I mean, there's five other lives that are dependent on you.
That's right.
Does that weigh on you in the moment, or is that something that doesn't really hit you till later?
You know, at the ages that us guys were at that time, we didn't have anything to worry about. It was different because you're young, you have no concerns. Hey, nothing's going to happen to me, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I'm pretty sure I didn't panic at all. No,
you weren't scared?
Yeah, a little bit.
Honest man. When you have a mission like that, and you do make it safely and against some challenges, is there something you guys do, the six of you as a crew, to celebrate that?
Well, might go to the pub and have a little shot.
Uh-huh. Was it ever to a point, I know 13 missions that you got in before the war came to an end, was there ever a point where you didn't really want to go on the next mission because of what you'd been through?
No.
And I know you write in your book here that you faced that flak, the anti-aircraft fire from the ground, just about every mission. There are also a couple occasions where you encountered enemy fighters.
Yeah, and I didn't see much of that because I had to keep my eye on the plane in front of me.
Right.
But out of the corner of an eye, I could see some fighters.
And I'm sure your crewmates were talking about it.
Yeah. I don't recall ever having any of my crew shot a plane down, though.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't get shot down. That was the important part. In those 13 missions, what was the most hair-raising moment for you, or the situation that you felt you came the closest to not being around or not making it back?
Well, I guess the one on which we got hit, obviously, I think.
Uh-huh.
And the first mission, I was just scared to death. But after that, my legs were okay. I wasn't shaking.
Uh-huh.
But I guess the mission where we got hit actually was that was the scariest one, yeah.
And you had the same crew for all 13 missions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You must have gotten to know those guys pretty well.
I did. I regret that I haven't followed through, and I didn't get any addresses or anything. We just broke up, and you know, that was it.
Have you ever tried to look them up in 70 years since?
One time, I don't use a computer myself, but
uh-huh.
I had my brother-in-law was over. he said, you know, you ought to see if you can get in touch with any of these guys. So we looked up. I told him my bombardier was from, I knew he was from Ohio. So he found out his name and phone number and everything. I never called.
No?
No, I said, what were they going to think of when I call, you know, 60, 70 years later? That everybody kept telling me, you know, that they would be delighted to hear from it.
I'm sure they would.
I'm just apprehensive about doing it.
All right. Well, if you ever change your mind, who knows? Who knows who might still be around? I'd be happy to look into some of that for you.
Time for another break, but when we come back, a pretty unique distinction. We've told you Cal was one of five brothers serving during World War II. Would you believe he actually got to fly one of those brothers in his airplane? He'll explain how all that came about and share the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.